Hey, while we're getting ready to study the word, I'm going to share this with you real quick, church. Yesterday, on the way back from Wyndham, I stopped off at my good friend Eric Meyerson's house, which he's a brother that I served with in the Orrington area. I just wanted to spend some time with him. He's the children's pastor there in Orrington. I just wanted to pick his brain in the area of children's ministry and, you know, multiple services and that kind of thing. And as I'm sitting there talking to him, he shares with me, yeah, Ken just told us, you know, we're gonna start a 6:30 a.m. service, then an 8:30, and then and it's like, man, they're really nutty over there in Orrington. They really are. They want to see God move. They want to make as much room possible for new people to come. And all I'm telling you is, I think the Lord blesses that. I really do. It does take work, and I'm just praying for this team. We would have, like it says in Nehemiah, a mind to work. Here's something just to consider, okay? Something I think our culture has done. And this is manipulation, but it's godly. You'll love it. Ready? Sunday, in our thinking as America, is part of our weekend. You guys know that? We consider Saturday, Sunday, that's the weekend. That's kind of new, okay? Sunday has always been the first day of the week. It's always been a work day. It certainly has always been a work day to God's people. It's not the weekend. It's the first day of the week. God hasn't, you know, amended his constitution, as some wrongfully teach, and taken Saturday and made it the new Sabbath Sunday. It's not wrong to work on Sunday. If you got to work, you work. I think Jesus is our Sabbath currently, New Testament theology. But I just ask that my fellow laborers here, my co-laborers, we would approach Sunday as a work day. Just something to think about. I think sometimes because we view it culturally as one of our days off, we kind of dabble in ministry sometimes, or we don't want to go all out. But you'd never perform that way on your job site, right? And just something to consider. The Levites certainly saw their time to serve the Lord as a work day. Even the Sabbath. And by the way, they were off the hook from God's perspective. They labor, and it's okay. So I just want to try to continue to encourage and challenge us that there's a lot of work to do, guys. There is so many people that aren't here. The 99, that's an awesome thing. But the heart of the shepherd is the lost, the one that's not here. He's willing to leave the 99 and go after the lost. And I've said that for a long time. I'm so thankful for who's here. But to me, the priority is who isn't here. Who isn't here? I'm not trying to grow this thing. I'm trying to be obedient to what God is doing. God's doing it, right? We've never advertised. Don't even know how. We're not slick enough. We've never gone after anybody. We just allowed people's personal witness to be the thing that draws people. And God's doing something here. I just want us to be on board with that. And I'm praying for myself and my team, those of us that serve together, for just a consecrated, total commitment. And I'm telling you, we only got to run a few more laps, guys, and we'll be in heaven. There is an awesome retirement package. There's reward in heaven. There's paradise. Think eternally. And it's just different, isn't it? So what's 70 years if we make it that far? just something the Lord's been speaking to me about. Thought I'd share it. Okay, in Esther, we have left off with Mordecai. And listen, I know the movie says Mordecai. My pronunciation marks put a long sound over the A and the I. Just trying to be faithful to my pronunciation marks. Mordecai. Appreciate the emails, but can't always trust the movies. Esther bade them return, and Mordecai this answer. Remember, Mordecai is challenging Queen Esther, the Jew. Listen, you are in a very, very pivotal position. You're in a unique role, Queen Esther, as a Jew. Plead with the king to save our people. How do you know that you weren't put there for such a time as this? And the sovereignty of God and the providence of God is really the doctrinal subject matter of Esther. You guys know that, right? When you look at the Old Testament stories, the Old Testament books, there are doctrinal themes, New Testament doctrinal themes that you see within the book. Esther, no doubt, is a study, a zeroed-in, zoomed-in study on the providence of God. That's a word that has left our vocabulary, by the way, as American people. It used to be, even in some of our founding documents, providence. Jonah, the doctrine of the book of Jonah, it's resurrection, right? Jesus Christ said so. Ruth, redemption. There's a doctrine there as you study the book of Ruth. It is the redemption of Christ, the love of Christ, right? Consecration and sacrifice, the doctrinal theme of Exodus. But when you study Esther, the doctrine is providence. God's orchestrating behind the scenes and accomplishing his will despite the faithfulness of people. Do we still believe in that? Do we still believe that God is on the throne? That we didn't vote him off as a people? He's just not subject to that. That he really is behind the scenes orchestrating things. And what sometimes looks like a bad scenario, once the smoke clears, you realize, oh my word, Lord, you were in this. You produced something amazing through trial and grit and fire and disaster. I still believe it. I've seen it in my life. I've seen him show himself strong in this area. Well, chapter 5, verse 1, Esther is determined to go for it. She realizes her life is at stake. But this takes an interesting twist, I think. Chapter 5, verse 1, now it came to pass on the third day that Esther put on her royal apparel and stood in the inner court of the king's house over against the king's house. And the king sat upon his royal throne. Royal throne, that's mine. Every time I get in my truck. Royal throne in the royal house over against the gate of the house. And it was so when the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the court, uninvited, by the way, that she obtained favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand, and Esther drew near, and she touched the top of the scepter. Then said the king unto her, what wilt thou, Queen Esther, and what is thy request? It shall be given thee to the half of the kingdom. This is the interesting part to me, church. Consider this. Esther says, all right, Mordecai, all right, cousin, I'm going for it. Pray, you know, she doesn't even say pray. She says, fast with me. Would you fast with me for 3 days? Me and my ladies are going to fast for 3 days. That's interesting to me. Even though time was of the essence, this is an urgent matter. People's lives are at stake. They still took 3 days and said, you know what? We're going to deny ourselves. We're going to fast. We're going to seek the Lord on this. That's amazing to me. Guys, sometimes when an individual or individuals say, you know what? I'm not going to give you an answer. I mean, I'm going to fast and pray. You know what that looks like to the world and the non-spiritual? That looks very irresponsible. You're going to what? We're going to die, Esther. We don't have 3 days. Well, I'm going to do it. I want to make sure God's in this. I'm going to make sure it's not me that's doing this. It's not my agenda. How frequently do you fast? That's a very fair question. And don't answer that, but just personalize it. Jesus, once again, did not say, if you fast. He said, when you fast. Do you ever get to the place where you just want to, for sheer practice and self-denial, say no to food? Just say no to food. Paul said something very interesting in one of his letters. He said, I will not come under the power of anything. Nothing is going to control my life, my appetites, but I beat my body in subjection. That is not to say Paul went around whipping himself. But he said he kept his appetites under him. In other words, the spirit of Paul was where he placed the authority. By the way, church, fasting is one of the most practical ways to do that. Just to say no to food. And there's a time to call a fast. We do that as a church. There's a couple times a year we say, hey, come on. The leadership's fasting. Would you fast with us? Pray with us. But the majority of your fasting ought to be between you and your father. Brothers, shave up. Look good. Don't let yourself go just so people say, what's wrong with you? I'm fasting. You know, it's supposed to be a secret thing. We're not trying to look spiritual in the eyes of man. That's not very self-denying at all. That's very self-promoting. But church, there's something to this. At the end of this 3 days of fasting, Esther takes a deep breath and she goes for it. And this is the thing that's amazing to me. Guys, remember her mindset. Remember the fears and concerns of her heart before she decided to go for it. She said, do you realize, Mordecai, this could kill me? When you rush into the presence of the king, people have been killed for that. The Persian Empire did not tolerate that you were invited in the king's presence only. If you just forced yourself into his presence, you are taking your life in your hands. And she came to that conclusion, which is a heroic statement. If I perish, I perish. I'm going for it. But here's the thing that's amazing to me. As she enters into the king's presence, the one chance she has if he lowers his scepter, that was a cultural statement, I permit you to come into my presence, even though you weren't invited. And no doubt her heart is thumping, right? She comes into that throne room, the door swings open, and everybody's like, whoa, what is going on here? Can this guy get a wife that's on board with the rules, right? If it's not that, now it's Esther. Those big palace doors came swinging open, and the queen comes and throws herself at the foot of this throne. And everyone's going, oh, man. And the king lowers the scepter. Her life was spared. Favor. Hey, think about this. Before she was determined to obey the will of God, do you notice how Queen Esther was thinking in worst case scenario? God's saying, do this. I want you to do this. This is my will for you. But God, what if this? And this could happen. And it's just so easy, without denying self, it's so natural and easy to think in worst case scenario. I want you to tell that individual about me. Him, God? He's a bad cat. What if he hates me? What if he hurts me? I don't know. What if my family never talks to me again? I don't want to offend anybody. We just think in worst case scenarios. I don't know how many times people have thought that way and they've shared their testimony. Listen, I was really intimidated to share the gospel with this individual, but I did it. And he got saved. Not just I didn't die, but salvation resulted in it. Could this be further from what Esther feared? Not only was she not killed, but half the kingdom was offered to her. Do you just see the contrast with me tonight, church? Fear versus faith. Being crippled in disobedient because of the what-if scenario, what could go wrong, versus when we just simply obey the Lord and do the thing he's calling to do, not only does the bad thing not happen, but exceedingly abundantly above what we could ever dream actually takes place. I'm telling you, God blesses and shows up when we recklessly follow his lead. That's true throughout the scriptures. Let me say this one more thing. I pray you consider it. Faith often looks reckless and irresponsible. I've said that a lot. I believe it. I've been up close and personal to that at times. But it isn't reckless and irresponsible. I want to make sure that's clear, too. It looks reckless and irresponsible to the world around you and the carnal around you, even within the church. But there is nothing more responsible and considerate when we respond to God's will. It's not irresponsible at all. Are you with me tonight? You guys with me? Very reckless and irresponsible, I'm sure, did it look when Abraham just packed his bags and left and couldn't tell any of his family members where he was going. I'm just going that way because God said so. You're walking away from your career, your wealth, you're leaving your family. Abraham, do you have a plan? I don't. I just know God's going to take me to a place. Looked very reckless and irresponsible, but it was the most logical thing he could do because God was speaking to his heart. You see the difference? Esther's concerned she's going to die if she does this, but you know what? If I die, I die. It's what's right. Not only did she not die, half the kingdom was offered to her. I dare say that is often the case when we deny our fears and do the thing that God has given us to do, church. Verse 4. Esther answered, "If it seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for him." Then said the king, "Cause Haman to make haste, that he may do as Esther hath said." So the king and Haman came to the banquet and that Esther had prepared. So listen, if you really want to give me anything, I just want you and Haman to show up. I prepared a snack, a little luncheon, a little late afternoon lunch. Would you just hang out with the queen? And no, the king is saying, oh, it's sweet. She wants to have time. I mean, I've been busy signing, ratifying. She just wants to spend, and Haman. The king said unto Esther at the banquet of wine, "What is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be performed." Then answered Esther, and this is amazing to me. Talk about a woman of self-control. She's got him. She's got the king. She's got Haman in the back room. It's just those three. She, no doubt she is very concerned about her people. She's very concerned about her own life. Remember, her ethnicity has been hidden. Her husband has no idea that she's a Jew at this point. And these things are boiling over. It is amazing to me that this lady, and please don't hear this the wrong way, ladies. It's amazing to me that she could just stuff her emotions and just play it cool. It's amazing. What a woman of self-control. She doesn't just explode, kill him, slaughter. You know, she doesn't do anything like this. She's like, all right, let's just do this thing incrementally. I'm going to trust the Lord. This is going in a good direction. What a lady. What a lady of virtue. So she doesn't. She doesn't pounce at the first opportunity. She doesn't tell all her mind. In fact, it says in Proverbs, the fool utters all his mind, right? The fool just bleeds emotionally all the time. Never leaves anything to discretion or privacy or between him and the Lord or her and the Lord. But the fool just constantly dumping everything. Not Esther. My petition, my request is, verse 7, if I found favor in thy sight, the sight of the king, if it pleased the king to grant my petition, to perform my request, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I shall prepare for them, and I will do tomorrow as the king has said. You want to know my request? Can we do this again tomorrow afternoon? I want some more time to think about it. I do have something I'd like, but I want some more time to think about it. Would you come back tomorrow? Was that nerves? I don't know. Was she, you know, it's just not good timing. Was she just sensitive to the moment? You wives know that, right? There's times when you hit your husband up. There's times like, eh, I'm going to wait till tomorrow. You understand? I'm going to wait till payday, then ask him. Whatever the case may be, this woman had unbelievable self-control. And her first request is, could we do this again tomorrow? I promise you, I'll let you know what's on my mind then. Or does she just know, let's let this thing go stale. Is this all strategy? Has she really thought this thing out? Can't prove either way, but it's fruitful. It works. This is where it gets good, guys. Check this out in verse 9. Then went Haman forth that day, joyful and with a glad heart. When you know the end of the story, you can't help but laugh, right? Haman leaves there, his chest full of air. Go, man, I get invited to private dinners with the king and queen. I am the man. I really am the man. And he's leaving that whole luncheon whistling until, as he leaves town, no doubt going back to his home, he sees Mordecai again at the king's gate. And it tells us that Mordecai, once again, stood not up. He did not have a respect of persons. Mordecai, no doubt, doing a task, sitting there as an elderly man. He doesn't go out of his way to move for this guy. He just looks at him. Afternoon. Oh, that made Haman mad. He wanted everybody to bow and acknowledge his awesomeness. This Jewish man just wasn't into it. Not a respecter of persons. How about us, brothers and sisters? Are we manipulated because of somebody's status or because of their bank account? Are we more easily swayed? Does our personality change when we're around certain people of status or success? I love the fact that Mordecai just wasn't down with it. You're just a man, you know? Go home. Have a great afternoon. You know, there just was no respect of persons in a carnal sense. I'm not talking about respecting an office or the president. I absolutely believe in respecting somebody who's worked hard and gained a title. I do believe in that. But I think that can cross a line, too, and become an idolatrous thing. You with me? And that's what we're dealing with here. It tells us, nevertheless, in verse 10, Haman refrained himself. He was full of indignation, we're told in verse 9, but he refrained himself. I even see this as an act of God. Could have snapped right there, but didn't. Again, God has a plan in all this. When he came home, he sent and called for his friends and Zeresh, his wife. Now, these last few verses that close out chapter 5, this really reveals the man. Guys, would you consider this with me and get sick to your stomach with me? People like this really exist. It's really creepy when you consider it. Look, he calls his friends up, like, guys, you got to come over. You got to come over. What kind of friends are that? They know what it's going to be. Do you have family members like that? You go and hang with them. It's just all about their successes and their accomplishments. It's all about what they have. They're just constantly showing you all their new stuff. And it's like when you have a Christian fellowship and you talk about Jesus and what he's doing in the community, isn't that just so disappointing? Don't you leave those like, I just need to take a shower. Do you know what I mean? Like, whoop-de-doo. Look, I want to have him over to my house and see all that I don't have. See our teeth? We smile. Big deal. This is no joke, guys. When I first moved into this community, and this minister has gone, so there's no risk in, you know, finding out who he is. But I had him spend the night. It was actually a local event at Machias Valley, a youth event. And I had this particular pastor over for the night. He lived out of town. He was far from this community. And I ain't kidding you, man. He asking me questions. So you just moved here. I think I'd only been in Machias for maybe 3 months or so, 6 months. And he's looking around, you know, the old building where the children's ministry used to be. That was where I lived first 2 years being here. And he looks around my home. He's like, well, you know, you really don't have much here. I'm like, I didn't know how to take that. I'm like, well, are you talking about, what are you talking about? I'm just so stupid I didn't even know. He's like, you know what you need to do? He said, you need to find 10 families that will give to you X amount of dollars a month, pay all your bills. And I was just like, you're really offending me, like this much, you know? And I'm really close to not letting you sleep in one of my rooms that I don't have, you know? What is that? You really don't have much. You know what? I have a lot. I have the forgiveness of Almighty God. I got little kids that are healthy who talk about God and sing songs. I got a wife that would lay her life down and has for me and what God has called me to. I have food every single day, even more than I should probably eat. I have toothpaste and a toothbrush. And when my toothbrush gets bristled, my wife puts a new one there. I have more than I can ask for, truthfully. I'm very thankful for what I have. I couldn't disagree more. I'm a spoiled brat. I have red squirrel in my freezer right now. Probably 12 of them, and sweet baby rays to go with it. Could you get better? And I mean that. I got frozen smelts. Yesterday, this is the cool thing, on the way home from Wyndham, I know it was Troy, poor Troy. He's like, man, hanging out with you is weird. I'm a magnet for weird. I'm going down Route 9. The one thing that I regret about down East Main and living here, the one thing, you ready for this? And it is horrible. You can't find a fiddlehead in this area. Where are they? You can't find a fiddlehead anywhere. And that bugs me, truthfully. I grew up on brook trout and fiddleheads. But man, yesterday, on the way home, we're plowing down Route 9. And there was the sign. There was a mountain of green gold. Fiddleheads, $3 a pound. Troy, you've got to pull over. I'll tell you, that was an adventure, man. That was 5 to 6 minutes of just chaos. I pull up to this shack of a house, and I no more open my door, and this man with long hair who was barely standing and was pretty sure I was Dale. Dale, he said, dude. And he can't get it. You're not Dale. I'm like, no, I'm not Dale, but I'm really interested. And listen, you guys, listen, those of you that have lived in the world, picture it. Big rounded mound of fiddleheads, little digital scale. I had to say something, hey, but I'll just tell you up front, this looks a little sketchy. He laughed. Yeah. I bought me 5 pounds of fiddleheads. I smelled them first. Was able to tell this guy, you know, Jesus loves you. Do you understand that? I know it. It was one of them things where I hope when he sobers up, another faithful servant can tell him about Christ. It was quite a scene. Before it was over, there was guys everywhere buying fiddleheads. But guys, here's the deal. That was a rabbit trail. I'm sorry. I got to kill that thing and get it back. My point is, I have those in my refrigerator. I have a lot. God has given me much. I am so very grateful for everything that God has given me. Let's get back to our text, okay? This man is an empty man. He's got riches to the nth degree. He is an empty, shallow little man. Look what it says in verse 11. Haman told them. Imagine coming over to Haman's house, sitting around his table. He told them of the glory of his riches. What did that sound like? Let me tell you guys about the sparkle of my rubies. I'm not going to believe this. The glory of my riches. I just brought you guys over tonight because I really wanted to talk about my stuff, my wealth. What kind of friend endures that? I suggest a friend that's hoping for a little piece of those riches, right? Then he goes on to say, and the multitude of my children, children in that day and age were considered a blessing. The more kids you had, the more prosperous you were. All the things wherein the king had promoted him and how he had advanced him above all the princes. And so there's a lot of people under me. I don't think you guys realize the power that I have. That's the meeting. That's their dinner meeting. Gross, huh? And then, verse 12, Haman said, moreover, yea, Esther the queen did let no man come in with the king unto the banquet that she had prepared but myself. I was the only one allowed to eat with king and queen. I know what you're thinking. That's why I had you over. But, and this really shows you the evil heart of this man. He says, tomorrow I am invited unto her also with the king. Tomorrow's going to be the same. Just more of the same tomorrow. Yet, all this availeth me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. But I'm not completely happy. What a spoiled little punk. I'll never be perfectly happy until he's dead. This is the type of guy that Mordecai was. Power had consumed this guy. It had literally made him insane. Insane with pride, insane with a lust for power, and insanely envious. Why did he hate Mordecai so much? You want to know why, I believe? Because he saw a man of virtue. He saw a man who was content and fulfilled and didn't have anything. And I think it really irritated this man, Haman. I think you know exactly what I mean. There are people that hate you because you have considerably less, and yet you want nothing. And it irritates them. I see that in this situation. Well, it's sad to me. What a sad little man. Verse 14, then said Zeresh's wife and all his friends unto him, let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high, and tomorrow speak thou unto the king that Mordecai may be hanged thereon. Then go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet. That's a sick suggestion from a wife that no doubt had been corrupted by her husband's success. And by the way, that is a very real possibility. You know what you ought to do, honey? You ought to build a 75-foot-tall gallows and hang that Jew. And then you'll have it all, won't you? Then you can go in whistling to your luncheon. What kind of sick people are we dealing with here? This is evil, church. And this is how pride can completely destroy you as a person. Lust for power and identity. And the thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. Don't forget that. He said, that sounds like a great idea. A 75-foot hangman's gallows. Chapter 6. On that night, the same night, could not the king sleep. And he commanded to bring the book of records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. I happen to disagree with King Ahasuerus, because apparently he finds history quite boring. I don't agree with him. But he can't sleep, and I think God's behind this, guys. God is behind this restless night of sleep. And by the way, sometimes you might experience that. It could be the pizza you ate. It could be the coffee. But consider the possibility that God is keeping you up. He's done that with me. And I think it's warm. I need more milk and honey. Warm. I need to do that. And the Lord's like, no, you need to pray, Aaron. And it's so good, man. Sometimes the Lord will shake you up in bed. I don't want your day to be done. I'm not done with you today. You were so busy. I'm telling you, I think the Lord has spoken to me in many, many times in profound ways, even ways that have drastically changed the direction of my life and ministry in that place between full consciousness and sleep. I'm telling you. It's almost like finally God's like, there, you're not in complete control of your brain, so let me get you thinking right for once. It's neat how God does that. I think God's behind this restlessness. The king says, listen, I can't sleep. Read some history to me. That'll put me out, surely. That'll bore me back to sleep. But God's into it, guys. Check it out. Verse 2. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains, the keeper of the door, who sought to lay hand on the king of Ahasuerus. You guys remember that in the very beginning of the book? Mordecai overheard a plot to kill and assassinate the king, and he was faithful to tell the king, listen, this is going on. I'm going to expose it. Well, apparently quite a bit of time had passed, and as they're reading the Chronicles to the king, he's reminded of that. And Ahasuerus, he goes from not being able to sleep to really, really convicted, really, really bugged that he hadn't given credit where credit is due. Look at verse 3. And the king said, what honor and dignity hath been done to Mordecai for this? Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, there is nothing done for him. King said, hey, that's right. I've gotten so busy. That guy saved my life. Did we do anything for him? Did we show him any appreciation at all? I mean, he exposed an assassination plot. I kind of want that to be known in the kingdom, that we appreciate that. And the servants say, no, we didn't do anything for that guy. They're looking through the minutes of all their board. No, we didn't send him a check. We didn't send him flowers. Nothing. The king is really, really perturbed by this. And just when he comes to that conclusion, he hears somebody stirring out in the outer court, whistling. You know who it is? It's Haman. He's there to convince the king to hang Mordecai. Isn't this precious, guys? You see how God is just moving pawn pieces, giggling in heaven? This is great. The king said, who is that? Who's in the court? Now, Haman was coming to the outer court of the king's house to speak unto the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. Doesn't he have some bad news ahead of him? The king's servant said unto him, behold, Haman standeth in the court. And the king said, let him come in. I wanted to talk to him. Haman came in, doesn't have an opportunity to talk to the king, his agenda. Immediately the king says, what shall be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor? Now this is a guy who's stuck on himself. Now Haman thought in his heart, to whom would the king delight to do honor more than myself? That's an arrogant cat right there. Well, he's got to be talking about presumption, church. That is called presumption. He's assuming much. So, well, since you asked, I've been actually thinking about that quite a bit lately, would you believe? Haman responds to this in verse 7. He says, for the man whom the king delighteth to honor, let the royal apparel be brought with the king, which the king useth to wear, and a horse that the king rideth upon, and the crown royal which is set upon. He said, I'll tell you, wear the king's costume. Dress up as the king himself. You can tell this guy had some ambition, can't you? You can tell ultimately that there was a desire to be the king. This is bitter envy, as the New Testament puts it. How about dressing up like you for a day? And wearing and even driving your horse. Yeah, driving your horse, that'd be great. And not only that, let the royal apparel be brought, which the king useth to wear, and a horse, and a crown. And let this apparel and the horse be delivered to the hand of the one who the king, kings, or one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man withal, whom the king delighted to honor, and bring him on horseback through the street of the city and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delighted to honor. So not only dress up like the king, ride the king's horse, have the king's crown, but may he have an escort through town saying, this is how the king blesses people right here. Just let it be known. This is awesome. And the king's like, I like it. And you're good. So here it is. And guys, don't you wish, this is one of those occasions where I so wish I could see the look on this guy's face. Don't you? Like we read about this morning, the princes of this world, once Christ arose, I would give anything to see the look on their faces. This is another one of those occasions. I think Haman is looking up into the sky right now. I think, you know, chariots of fire are playing in the background. He's just thinking, man, yeah. And here it is. Here's the punchline. Then, verse 10, the king said to Haman, make haste and take the apparel and the horse, as thou hast said, and even do so to Mordecai the Jew. I think he just heard a toilet flush. What? Oh, no. Mordecai the Jew that sitteth at the king's gate, let nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken. Haman's the one that's actually leading him through town. Guys, this is sweet. This is sweet. This is God and his way of vindicating. Imagine it, guys. Imagine Haman himself bringing this Jew, this elderly Jewish man, dressed up like the king, on his horse, with the crown, saying, this is how the king... He's probably crying, trying to hold it together. It's just... This is too... I've seen God do this in real time. I've seen God take an individual who the world mocked and scoffed at, and the Lord honored an individual. He's into that, guys. He's into... Listen to me. God is so into honoring the underdog. I'm telling you, God's team is made up of the JV class B type. You guys with me? You guys remember that whole, I do, in eighth grade soccer. I'm still bitter about it. Still bitter. Now, I wanted to play soccer. you know, I want to play with all my jock friends. And I'm not trying to whine, but I didn't have a dad that played ball stuff. I never did anything with a ball as a kid. An eight ball. Does she love me? But that was it. Will she date me? No, you're weird looking. Ah, bummer. I never had like any kind of sport. You know, my mom did her best to do like wiffle ball with us boys. But anyway, I'm over it. So soccer, and I tried really hard, and you know, I'm just not really, I don't have finesse. I just have accepted it. And all my friends got on the A team, and I got stuck on the B team. I'm an eighth grade kid with like fifth and sixth grade kids all around me. I was so angry. I remember being so angry. I just was like, you know what? I just beat all the kids up. We had our first practice. I just went, kicked all the kids, and there were little fifth and sixth grade kids all. And I was like, I quit. I was just so angry. Well, God is into taking the underdog. Listen, my point is this. I was always that kid at the very end. You know, remember captains? That's a demonic thing to do. You take the most athletic jocks and you say, you're a captain and you're a captain. Pick teams. That is horrible. I've been on the receiving end of that my whole life. You pick this guy. I want this guy. I want, and then at the end, we'll take Dudley. What? Oh, it's just a horrible thing. You know, and the cool is, do you guys understand? God chooses exactly opposite. He picks Dudley first. You're with me, right? You understand what I'm saying? He picks Dudley first. Because listen, if anything cool happens with Dudley, everyone's going to go, there is a God in heaven. He picks differently than this world. I love it, man. I just love to see how God takes the scoffed at and makes them the heroes. It's really cool. So, listen. This ends really well. It says in verse 12, and Mordecai came again to the king's gate, and Haman hasted to his house mourning and having his head covered. That's precious, right? When the whole scene is over, Haman runs to his home. He can't even let people see his face. He's so humiliated. Precious. And Haman told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends, I bet that's a different meeting, everything that had befallen him. Then said his wise men, these were astrologers, right? These are people that were tuned into the stars, and you know, that was the day and age. The wise men of the Persian Empire read the zodiac. And they're basically suggesting, you know, your stars aren't lining up at this point, man. This isn't looking good. The wise men and Zeresh, his wife, said unto him, if Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews, before whom thou hast begun to fall, thou shalt not prevail against him, but shall surely fall before him. This is going to end bad for you. Revelation. And while they were yet talking with him, came the king's chamberlains and hasted to bring Haman unto the banquet that Esther had prepared. It's amazing to me that this didn't dawn on him at this point. He didn't realize, man, this is starting to smell like a setup. This might not be good. Well, we got 5 minutes left, guys. Let's just go a little further. Let me read some. So the king and Haman came to the banquet with Esther the queen. And the king said again to Esther on the second day at the banquet of wine, what is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? And it shall be performed even to half the kingdom. Esther knows this is my moment. Some things have materialized. Some things have transpired in the last 24 hours. This is her moment. Then Esther the queen answered and said, if I found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me. That's all I want, my life. This is really getting the king's attention. What? I want my life and my people's life. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed. There's a contract out on me and my people's lives, to be slain and to perish. If we'd been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I had held my tongue. Listen, it was just about being slaves. I was willing to let that go. But they want to kill us. There's money on us so that we're dead. Although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage. Then the king Ahasuerus answered and said unto Esther, the queen, who is he? And where is he? Can you feel it? Husbands in the room, your wife is crying. And listen, someone's trying to kill me. And my whole family. Can you imagine the rage that would well up inside you? As a man, as a man who loves his wife, who is it? Where is he? There's a righteous rage here. I'm not suggesting he's a righteous man. Thou dost presume in his heart to do so. And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. Then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen. I'd give $1,000 to see that face, too. Ooh! He's right in the middle of drinking wine, pinky in the air. Ooh! I think, listen, if you come here, I'm kind of a little crass, but I think his butt cheeks went real tight. Ooh! You know, real tense situation. Is it gluteus maximus? That's probably better. I think that happened. I do. Okay. This wicked Haman. And the king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden, and Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther the queen, for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. Apparently, as the king exited, he flashed him a glance, and that man interpreted that as, that is not a good look. I'm in big trouble. This man was so mad, he had to remove himself from the situation. Just walked out of the room. He was so outraged, he just didn't even know what to do. And he goes and he's pacing in the garden. This evil man Haman realizes, I have seconds to plead for my life. This just goes from bad to worse. The king returned out of the palace garden into the place. Yeah, the king leaves his bride for a time. Enemies roaming around seeking whom he may devour. The king returns, though, church. Vindicates, sets his bride free. Don't miss the picture there of our Lord Jesus. The king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine, and Haman was fallen upon the bed wherein Esther was. He is pressuring her, but it doesn't look good. He comes into the bedroom scene, and he's laying on the bed, forcing, not sexually, but it appears that way. Just you're going to tell the king this is all a lie. He's trying to manipulate at this point. Then said the king, will he force, and I think he wasn't whispering myself, will he force the queen also before me in the house? As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And Harbona, one of the chamberlains, said before the king, this is a snitch. This is a righteous snitch. Tattletaling isn't always bad. Hey, you might not know this. I want to tell you this. He's got gallows, big gallows behind his house. I've been watching him build them. That's awesome. You got to have at least one of those children in your family, right, that will rat on all those naughty little kids. I'm not going to expose who it is, but I got one to say, Dad, just so you know, they're building a bomb outside. Just so thankful for that little guy. I'll back him up. I'll protect him, protect his identity. Harbona, hey, while you're really angry, I ought to tell you something. He's been building a 75-foot gallow to kill Mordecai. You know the guy who protected you? Just thought you ought to know. And then he goes on to say, the king said, hang him on it. Perfect. Hang him on it. Verse 10, so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. Can you picture that? Guys, you reap what you sow. Bitterness, church. It's been said that bitterness, and to live in bitterness, meaning there's somebody in your life that you're unwilling to forgive and you just wish wrong on them. You know what bitterness is? It's like drinking poison while you're watching and waiting for that person that you're bitter against to die. You're the one that's being consumed. You're the one that's being destroyed. That's bitterness. And what a picture here. Such a hate-filled man. But the very thing that he desired to do was the thing that was done to him. Proverbs, what is it? Proverbs 26, 27. He who digs a pit will fall therein. He who rolls a stone will have that stone rolled upon him. You live by the sword, you die by the sword. Now, it's better to serve people, lay your life down. Better to reap what you sow, or better to reap good seed. Sow good seed so that we reap good seed. Perfect timing. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the principles that we see in this book, Lord. Thank you for the reality that you are on the throne. You are on the scene, Lord. We don't ever have to worry that the world has gotten out of control from your perspective. You're still very much in control. You still are orchestrating all the things behind the scenes, Lord. All these powerful governments and militaries, most of them corrupt, if not all. They don't concern you a bit, Lord. They're all ultimately puppets, part of your plan to bring this whole human race to a prepared state to receive you, the true King. Thank you for that, Lord. Thank you for that reminder. The issues that we have going on around here, our needs, Lord, our needs as a church family, our need for direction, the Sunday morning space problem, Lord, it is a comfort to know you are in control. Guide us, Lord. That's our prayer. Direct us. And may we be willing to obey whatever it is you lead us to do. And Father, we're so grateful. Thank you so much for our time to visit now. I certainly pray that your spirit would be at work as we just visit and laugh and get ready for our week ahead of us. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.